This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Gentlemen, prepare for the smell of burning rubber as we welcome to the stage in conversation with Tobias Muse. Please give a warm welcome to Mark Beaumont.
Right. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for being here. This is a fairly exciting moment, not just for you, but for me. This is a tiny bit of hero worship with the great Beaumont here to my left. So, who doesn't know who this man is, first off? Raise of a hand. So, you don't need two people. So, you don't need much. And three. Okay, that's a pretty good ratio of, like...
They're being kind.
Yeah, they're being very kind. So, you know, he can, like, cycle quite long distances. He's got an enormous quantity of chamois cream stashed in his cupboard in his bedroom. He likes cycling around the world a lot. And so, essentially, he flew in this morning on a plane from Florida to be here right now. Slightly delayed plane as well.
Yeah, I got here just in time. I got 1 hour sleep last night. Flew back from Florida with two toddlers. So I've had a few stiff coffees, but... Fantastic to be here and sharing some of the adventures. I mean, if anyone was following recently, they'll know that about 3 months ago we finished a bit of an epic. So I've been enjoying a bit of downtime, a bit of family time.
Yeah. So you must know that Mark has just cycled around the world in 80 days, which is a fairly extraordinary figure for most people. But obviously, if you remember, going back 11 years ago. Mark came into our lives, stepped into our living room pretty much for doing a kind of similar sort of thing, but in a very different sort of way, which is kind of odd. The similarity is going around the world, but the actual process was very different. So talk us through kind of there and now, basically.
Yeah, so graduating with a perfectly decent economics degree, I plan to be an accountant, to be honest, and it's not happened yet. I had this big dream to go on one big bike ride to end all bike rides. I mean, this was not meant to be a career. My dad was very clear about that. And this was simply, I was a 12-year-old kid who had cycled across Scotland. These adventures had got bigger and bigger and bigger over a decade. And I was then in my early 20s going, let's go on one big trip to end all trips. And I thought, well, if I've only got one chance, it's got to be around the world. You know, I'm in student debt. What's a bit more debt? Let's just go for it. So quite naively, but isn't that the best way, I set out to cycle around the world. And I assumed that that record was something coveted, professional. I thought it would be up there with the round the world sailing record. Whereas 10 years ago, it had barely been looked at. Now, I don't wish to be disparaging about anyone who cycled 18,000 miles, but the record 10 years ago was really, really slow. It stood at 276 days. And I looked at that and I thought, that can not just be bettered, but let's take that to a whole new level. So 2007, 2008, I cycled around the world the first time and went at the speed of 100 miles a day, which back then was considered fast. And 100 miles a day for 18,000 miles, you can do the maths. It took me just over half a year, including flights and whatnot. So I pedaled around the planet alone, unsupported, in a time of 194 days, which was a big BBC One documentary called The Man Who Cycled the World, which was my first book and kind of what started all this.
So when you finished that event, I mean, at the beginning, it was just a really big adventure. But obviously, yeah, then TV became involved, and you must have had an inkling then that this actually might suddenly take over your life.
Yeah, I mean, the risk is you sort of reverse engineer these things and say, you know, I plan to do it that way. The reality is, I set out with this ambition. I mean, as you can see there, completely different, much hairier, and just wanting to go on a big adventure for me. I mean, this was before social media existed. Mm. So the only reason I really got cameras involved is because I couldn't afford this trip. So I thought the only way to thank my sponsors was to film it and televise it. So I, as a student, very naively walked into BBC Scotland, literally just walked in. You can't do that anymore because they've built a new BBC Scotland with security gates. The old building, if you know Glasgow, by the Botanic Gardens, you could just walk into the canteen area. That's how I got my break into television, asking people who made documentaries, and I thought, I'm just going to do this so I can give them return on investment. I had no interest in story make and broadcasting, but through the process of doing that, I met a couple of people who took me under their wing, had a wonderful apprenticeship for the next 4 or 5 years in the filming, in that whole sort of spirit of capturing real life stories for screen time, and it's become a huge part of what I do. But these things evolved. I always think the risk with stories like this is you sort of look back and you sort of say boldly, yes, I always planned to forge a career in telly and whatnot. I didn't. That happened off the back of just wanting to go on an adventure.
Because back then, there must have been a certain degree of, I mean, if you're self-filming, for those who've done this, often you end up placing a camera down the road, you then cycle back quite a long way, and then you kind of cycle back into the camera again, pick it up and carry on going. I mean, you know, to get those wide shots, to get those GVs, but now, the difference is, of course, there are people doing that for you, as opposed to...
Yeah, I mean, the filming's obviously changed hugely, because I mean, in the most recent race around the planet, I went with a full film crew, support team. I mean, I was absolutely out and out racing, doing 240 miles a day for 2.5 months. Now, you compare that to a mere 100 miles a day. When you're riding a century a day, you've got time to stop and put the camera down and to... If you think for weeks on end, the only thing you talk to is this inanimate object at arm's length. But if you also think that 11 years ago I was filming onto mini DV, I was filming onto cassette, this was analog, and then I was couriering back the tapes, and a week or 10 days later, there'd be a huge sigh of relief when it made it back to London and then Glasgow, and we knew that we had it in the can. Whereas now, of course, you would never run the risk of filming something in the field and then not having it backed up once or twice before sending it back. I mean, the investment with the broadcast projects now, whereas we're only talking about a decade ago where it was as simple as that. Myself out there with a handy cam filming onto basically a cassette, which then got couriered back on a hope and a prayer. And if it made it back, it was in the documentary. If not, oh well. So, I mean, I think it's fascinating because my next big expedition was riding the length of the Americas, Alaska, we've got the map, Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, which was 9 months going down the length of the Rockies and the Andes. And I can remember when the camera guy from BBC came to me and he said, look, I want you to take this newfangled thing called Twitter with you and try and tell the story as you go. And I said to him, that's going to be such a waste of time and such an unnecessary distraction for me on the road. You know, little did I know what that would become and how, not just how important that became for the storytelling, but also how it completely changes the mindset for you on the road when you're doing the journey. You're not just living it for yourself to then be made into a story afterwards in either a documentary or a book. But it's happening in real time. I mean, really now, when people get to the end of these journeys, when they pick up the book or they read the film, they feel like they're reading a sort of an edited, concise version of what happened. Whereas if you followed it in real time, day to day to day, followed that tracker, followed the, you know, every posting, every blog, you know, you've got it warts and all. You've got the entire story. So that's the challenge, but that's also the value of how much traveling, storytelling, broadcasting in my world has changed. But I'm sure the same for you.
But I think, the thing I'm always amazed by is if you're, you know, as you know, if you're cycling, if you can vaguely imagine cycling 240 miles a day repeatedly for 80 days, or almost 80 days, I mean, you're going to be quite tired, aren't you? So clearly, the last thing you probably want is a camera stuck in your face and, do you have a few words or, you know, how are you feeling at the moment? Well, how were you feeling most of the time? But, you know, internally, you're going, oh, God. Externally, you have to put on a different face.
Yeah. I think that's a common question insofar as people think, oh, it's difficult to turn it on for the camera. But if you've ever actually seen me on the YouTube or the Facebook posts are that there's no acting, there's no pulling the punches. Mm. I try not to swear too much, but I'm just blethering to the camera. You know, when you catch me at 3:30, 4 in the morning, there's no sort of reading off a script or thinking about what I'm saying. What I'm normally doing is just talking through my thoughts for the day, and then later on you're just catching up on what I've been through. Let me push through here a second, because I've got a clip that I can show you which sort of shows this point. I mean, on the 80 days which we've just completed, this was last summer, July, September, October. I mean, this is me out there racing from 4 o'clock every morning until 9:30 at night. So can you imagine, you're on the bike for 4 times 4 hour sets a day, 16 hours a day. And I had a film crew with me the whole time. We'll come back to this, which is a day which didn't go so well. But you can see the change between a decade ago and now. You know, the wild man, completely unsupported, to full-on racing like this. This is a shot in China. I've just done the first 5,000 miles of this race through from Paris, so through Europe, Russia, Mongolia, China. And this little clip shows me chatting away on the road. I was cycling the last kilometre to Badalang and the Great Wall of China. This is the end of leg one. There you go, the sun setting's behind me. It's 7:10 at night. 6,675 miles from Paris in 28 days. So I think that's about 238 miles a day average. I'll take that. And what a finale to China. It's been awesome. My greatest hope was to stay on target for leg one, but I was willing to accept that with all the logistics and tricky border crossings and unknowns, I might be chasing time heading into leg two. So to be bang on target, exciting. I think my support team's stuck in traffic somewhere behind me, so it's nice just to have a little moment and appreciate that I'm a long way from Paris. Thanks for all the support, everyone.
So, I mean, that's an extraordinary. I mean, just even try and comprehend going from Paris to China in 28 days. That's quite a lot. So, I want to go back a bit and go. When did you think it was feasible to cycle around the world in 80 days? I mean, as you know, we know the story of Phileas Fogg, but when did you go? Oh yeah, I reckon this is doable.
Well, I mean, to join the dots quickly, in a decade we went around the world the first time, length of the Americas, but then I was quite keen to leave the bike at home and do something else. The truth of the matter is I wanted to join the dots. I felt like I'd gone around the world and top to bottom, but I wanted to figure out how to cross the oceans as well. So I spent the next 3 years ocean rowing. I joined a team, filmed a doc called Rowing the Arctic. We took a rowing boat further north than anyone had ever gone before, 800 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And then I tried to break the world record for rowing the Mid-Atlantic, but after 28 days, capsized and spent 14 hours paddling around trying to be rescued. So that was a big turning point. Very, very nearly didn't come home from that. Mm. And I had a bit of a sabbatical in my athletic career after that, hopefully for understandable reasons, and got married 8 weeks later, which was not a knee-jerk reaction, but that happened straight away. And I thought, well, I'm just going to turn the camera the other way and I'm going to tell other people's stories. So I spent 2 years being the lead presenter for the build-up to the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. Traveled around the entire Commonwealth. And my job was to hear other people's stories for 2 years, which I absolutely loved. I was inspired by, but I was also green with envy. I was really jealous. I couldn't take myself out of the equation. I couldn't just be asking the questions. And I came home when the games finished in August 2014, and I said to my wife, I'm not done yet. I can't be done yet. If there was no business in it, if there was no broadcast in it, if it was just for me, I just want to go out there, put all my cards on the table and figure out what's possible. I don't want to look back and have any regrets. I want to really shoot for the stars and figure out how fast you can go. And if I'm going to do this, it's for one prize only, and that's the world. I mean, everything else is small talk compared to the world, the circumnavigation. And so I said to Nikki, look, we're going to risk big here, but can I have until the kids go to school? Does that sound like a reasonable negotiation? For me to go back to being a professional bike rider. and just figure out what's possible here. And that's when I started to put a team together and speculate, how fast can we get around the world? How fast can you go 18,000 miles? And quite early on, I settled on 80 days, but a lot of people, even close to me, said that was impossible, because to get around the world in 80 days is 75 days riding, 3 days flights, 2 days contingency. Now, if you're a good elite level endurance bike rider, you might be able to imagine going 240 miles on your bike. I don't know where 240 miles is from here. It's a long way. Maybe Newcastle, maybe a bit further. But 240 miles is not a day when the sun is shining, you've got a cracking tailwind, and you absolutely manage to bust it out and just about make the miles. 240 miles is your average day. And you've got to do that every single day for the next 2.5 months.
So some days are a lot bigger than that, and some days are less. So.
Yeah, and you know what it's like. Yeah. Depending on the topography, the way the wind blows, border crossings.
If it's mountainous, it's going to be...
Yeah. So a lot of people said, this is crazy. Why risk the sponsorship? Why risk your reputation? Why risk everything on the 80 days? Wouldn't it be better to try and go for the world record, which stood at 123 days... and then surprise everyone by going sub-80. Why be so bold as to go out there and call the whole project around the world in 80 days, whereas if I came home in 18.1 days, it would kind of look like I'd failed. That was kind of what... Some sponsors didn't sponsor me because they said the 80 days is just risking too much. Well, you don't need to be a PR genius to get the 80 days. I mean, the romantic side of it, I've grown up with the Victorian fiction. I love the notion... It's such a one-time prize. Can you, under your own steam, get around the world in 80 days? Nobody's ever done it. I was like, I've got to do it. I believe it's possible, so that's what we're going to do. And it was then finding a team around me who could buy into that. So, I mean, it might look like one guy on a bike, but I had 40 people work on this project around me. I mean, this was a three-year project, which... You know, not to spoil the punchline, but we came home in 78 days, 14 hours and 40 minutes. So go back to the sum that I gave you: 75 days riding, 14 hours and 3 days contingency, and 3 days flights, 2 days contingency. So we came home
on time, early.
We used 14 hours out of our 48 hours contingency. So. To go 18,000, it sounds a bit boring, doesn't it? You know, the romantic notion is you set out from Paris and you figure out what's possible. Yeah. You go hell for leather and you figure out how fast you're going to go. The reality is, we spent 3 years planning this and we absolutely read it off script. It was so hard, physically, mentally, logistically. We couldn't be figuring it out on the road. I've never taken myself to a harder place.
I'm just trying to picture how I had to plan how to get here with Google Maps. And, you know, it gives you an estimated time of arrival, works out platform changes, and you kind of have like 38 minutes, and you go, okay, cool. And if you arrive early, you can feel quite pleased with yourself. Imagine trying to say, I will see you in 78 days and 14 hours, and stick to it. I mean, I think if Google Maps could somehow predict your thing on your journey, say, start in Paris and I just need to get back here again, how long will it take? You know, it won't be 80 days. I mean
that's why it's such a big team. I mean, I can't claim credit to most of that. I mean, that's my logistics guys. It was insane.
So the team, I mean, were they all people you'd worked with before? Did you find them specifically for this?
Some were, some weren't. My performance manager in that photo, Laura Penhall, I mean, I've known her for years.
She's a great Atlantic rower herself, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she's been a top physio at 3 Olympics, so top of her game as a physio, but she's also rode the Pacific Ocean. I was looking for people with that sort of caliber. People who had the technical ability, the training, but also had the real life experience. You know, my logistics manager has supported Ram Race Across America for the last 5 years, knows exactly how to support the world's biggest bike races. He's also spent 35 years in the military running logistics. You know, I needed those sorts of people. But to your point, You can't plan to that degree. Things are going to go massively wrong. You're just trusting the long-term average takes care of itself. If you put the same effort in every single day, then you just have to trust in the long-term you're going to come home when you say you will. I mean, there was days where I would do 180 miles. There's other days I'd do 280 miles. Yeah. But you just got to be utterly obsessed on the bike at 4 a.m. Something I stressed with my team before I left, if we faff It's a technical term. If we faff for 5 minutes every time I'm off the bike, that adds 2 days to the world record.
Yeah.
So 4 o'clock start, a.m. means 4 o'clock. A 20-minute break means a 20-minute break.
Yeah.
The margin of errors in this were zero. So you might sort of think, well, this takes the fun out of travel, but it's also pretty exciting when you see the world at pretty much, you know, 1,000 miles every 4 days. You know, you're crossing, you know, Russia. You cross Europe in a country a day. You cross, like, the Mongolian plateau and the Gobi Desert, the Australian outback. I mean, down through the Yukon. I mean, these are wonderful landscapes to see from dawn till dusk at such pace.
Because the thing is, I mean, you could argue, it for a lot of people, it sounds amazing, but some people might say it doesn't sound fun because it's hard work, clearly, maintaining that sort of miles. But, you know, you say, you know, you're just sitting in zone one, just basically coasting along at 14 miles an hour, whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You're not busting a gut because you're protecting yourself.
Yeah. It's a feeding exercise. You must have eaten a lot of food.
Yeah, you're 9,000 calories a day.
That's a lot, isn't it?
But also, it's... is it fun? I mean, fun's an interesting word, isn't it? It's what I call type 2 fun, which I'm sure you're very well aware of. You know, it's not that often a bundle of fun in the moment, but it's the sort of thing which is really the life-affirming, career-defining stuff. You know, the sort of thing that you look back on really fondly. I often think that, you know, if you go through life trying to just find type 1 fun, the stuff that's instantly gratifying, it's just a bit easy. You know, if you go to the pub and you have a pint, that's type 1 fun. But when you're sitting in the pub having a pint, you're talking about type 2 fun. You're talking about the stuff which really beat you up, but you loved. You know, when you're in a storm battering at 4 a.m. in the morning, trying to make a ferry from South Island to North Island, there's trees, like branches coming down across the road, it's dark, it's battering with rain and wind, it's hell, it's horrible. You wish you were anywhere else. I look back on that and go, that's the good stuff, you know? You don't wish to be there, but I'm glad I've been there.
Did you, I mean, like, with breaking world records, there are rules, aren't there, clearly?
Yeah.
Lots of rules. And so just talk us through a bit about the route and how it differed from the first time you did it versus this time. And what do you need to do in order to be an official around the world? I mean, there's you have to work on longitude and latitude a bit, don't you?
Yeah, so all land-based circumnavigations for your research are 18,000 miles. So if you want to run it, people have run it, walk it, cycle it, drive it, motorbike it, 18,000 miles. That's your official number.
Okay.
Start finishing the same point. Always go in the same direction. Never go back on yourself and hit two antipodal points. So 2 points on the opposite side of the planet. I think you're allowed plus minus 2 degrees on that.
Wow. Okay.
So my antipodal points were Madrid and Wellington. And they're obviously quite hard to find because there's not a lot of landmass in the southern hemisphere. Apart from that, you can choose whichever route you want. So the first time I went from Paris, same start finish point, but I went the southern route through Asia, through Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, India, and flew out of Calcutta. Whereas this time I went far further north. Last time was a bit dodgy going around Balochistan, around the border of the Helmand province and up through, you know, parts of Pakistan. So to do that with a full media crew and support team would have been difficult. So to go through Russia, Mongolia, down through the Gobi Desert to China and out of Beijing was a far faster option this time. Russia was tough, though. I mean, really tough. Day nine, I crashed hard.
Yeah.
And we can laugh about it now, but this nearly ended the whole race. I mean, what's happening here is when I crashed, I broke some front teeth and made quite a number of them wobbly. And I also landed on my left hand, which fractured my radial head. So I put a crack through my left elbow. So then through some pretty rough roads through Russia, and I still had 2 months to ride, I was nursing some pretty uncomfortable injuries. So this is my bike mechanic and my physio rebuilding my teeth.
He looks a bit like Bob Geldof.
At the roadside. He's a character. He's completely unqualified to do this. Rebuilding my teeth just east of the Ural Mountains in Russia. So that's, yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, sorry, you're going to do the video.
I was flicking back and forwards.
Because clearly, the first time you did this, you were single, and now you're not. And there's a big thing, isn't there? I mean, we're suddenly having a family and that thing to come back to, and you're managing home. So, how often did you chat to Nikki, and did she say, oh God, I've had a crap day, the postman didn't come today, you know, got a parcel coming, and oh, I don't know, something, or your children are, you know, having moments, you're kind of, were you managing home at all, or was it very much, this is all I'm doing?
I think it's honest and important to say that I'm not the world's best husband or dad when I'm on expedition. I hope I am at other times. Yeah. Hence, just flying back from Disneyland this morning. But my wife, thankfully, she's a million miles from me in terms of she's not an athlete, she's not an adventurer, but she does buy in and get what I do. So I don't feel like I'm on borrowed time doing what I do. This is my job, and I don't feel like I need to justify it. She understands when I go into that performance mindset, I really need that clarity. So I can't really relate to walking the dog or even the kids going to nursery or the weekly food shop when I'm 16 hours a day racing. I just can't relate. And so it's not like I'm not sympathetic, I just don't have the capacity. And so I would talk to Nikki probably 3-4 times a week, but she would know not to try and get me out of that sort of bubble, that zone. And I would probably only chat to the kids once or twice a week. And actually, Nikki stopped showing my daughters my videos, especially the ones in the morning, because they said Daddy's quite scary when he's on the road. That sort of, I might show you that in a second, actually, if we've got time. I don't know.
We've got a few minutes, yeah.
And even Laura, my performance manager on the road, quite often used Nikki as a sounding board. If I was in a really difficult, dark place, rather than sort of confronting me directly, she would phone Nikki and say, right, this is going on. How should I approach it with Mark? It makes me sound like a complete animal on the road. But I think one of the things I said with my team before I left is, I've got this project to the start line. I've driven it to the start line. And I am now handing you the baton. It's your job to get me around the world. I'm just the guy on the bike. Don't look to me for leadership, camaraderie, anything. I'm going to go to idiot mode. I'm just riding my bike now. So it was really important that they were the leaders. They had the responsibility. And I could just sort of zone out and ride my bike. And so nobody really was looking to me for anything, emotional support, decision making or anything. I think that's massively important. And it allowed me just to feel sorry for myself and ride the bike. I'll quickly show this clip
and it will show.
That's
his start day 47. And slept deeply, but only for just over 4 hours. So woke a couple of times hearing the rain on the night. Laura's looked at the weather charts and it's quite a big storm coming this morning. You can feel the wind moving the motorhome and it's right on the nose. So, looks like...
So you can imagine, that's you at 3:30 in the morning. You've got 4 or 5 hours a night sleep and that's all you get for 2.5 months. And then 16 hours riding every single day. It's pretty hard to relate to home life.
Well, as a parent, you can. It's a bit like, you know, unbroken sleep, being woken up constantly by young kids, and
that's similar. Good
preparation, isn't it?
Very similar.
So you obviously lived in a bubble for 80 days plus then some.
Yeah.
So that bubble, which is basically, you know, wake up, ride, sleep, wake up, ride, eat, with a lot of eating in between.
Yeah.
What did it feel like when you came to the end? You know, suddenly being out of this massive routine, which hasn't stopped.
I mean, utterly bizarre. I don't think you'll talk to anyone who's been on any big journey who says the end is what you dream it to be. You know, the end is always very odd because you've overthought it. And also, the end had become such a massive media event and such a big event for everyone else. I think their excitement almost stole it from mine. I was so in this routine of, you know, racing the planet. And I had loved it. You know, it was been brutal. I'd hurt every single day, but I'd absolutely loved it. The camaraderie, the support, the sense of momentum, the sense of purpose. It's hard to put into words. And then I rode those final miles into Paris and quite a big peloton in the end came out and rode with me. And the world's media was on me. This was the 18th of September, you know, just last year. And it's just utterly bizarre. I mean, I think the level of exhaustion I was going through, you go for 2.5 months in that mindset and then you stop and you really do stop. You really do crash. It probably took me a matter of weeks it's probably only just starting to happen where I've actually got time to stop and think. I mean, the 11 days I've just taken off with my family is my first time out since finishing in September. And it's the first time I've actually stopped and had any time to think about it and get perspective on it. And I'm starting to write the book, the 80 days book. But that process doesn't happen on the finishing line.
And also, you would have been, I mean, without sounding rude, but you would have been essentially in a very selfish, self-preserving mode. I mean, it's all about me, basically. And then suddenly, it's like, so how was your day, darling? And was it a bit suddenly, you know, kind of like, where do you even start trying to catch up with your wife after 80 days on the road? And say, so, been a good couple of months, you know? Kids all right? Doing well at school? You know, that kind of thing? You know, it's sort of...
And I don't know, I mean... Any performance athlete has to get into that mindset where ultimately it is about your performance. Yeah. But you cannot live like that when you come home. But it doesn't make you a complete ego to say that it's hard to switch out of it like that. When you've got a team of 6 to 8 people on the road, willing your every movement from the moment you wake up at 3:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night, every second of the day counts, and then you stop. And, you know, if I even thought, oh, hot chocolate, 5 minutes later I'd have a hot chocolate, it's wonderful. I mean, that side of it's great. But when you come back and you've got kids and a dog to walk, and life doesn't happen like that.
No.
But you can't switch out that mindset quite so quickly.
Well, obviously, I mean, the thing is, we're truly a travel writers festival here. So one of the glorious things about writing is that you get to relive your moment. But it's sometimes quite hard because luckily for you, you've got lots of photos, you've got video, you've got stuff to jog your memory. And there'll be certain conversations that obviously stand up in your mind and others that you kind of vaguely have to, shall we say, illustrate with a bit of imagination because you can't remember things very, very clearly because so much has happened. So when you come to sit down and write about your experiences, which is a fantastic legacy to your kids, do you find the process very cathartic? Is it enjoyable? Is it a bit kind of like, oh, God, there's moments where I don't want to really think about that again? Or
yeah, all of the above. I kind of feel because all the journeys I've been on, I've been with an intensity, with a purpose. I've almost got more time to relive them during the book writing than I do at the time. You know, there's never a moment on the road. I'm not a nomadic traveler, so I'm never sitting there around a campfire sort of going, wow, that happened. It's always just a next, a next, a next, a next. And because I've always got a wonderful video diary, audio diary, photo diary on the road, there's never really a challenge remembering what happened. I've also, thankfully, got a good memory. So I often find myself, the real emotions come out during the writing process. I mean, I'll laugh, I'll cry, I'll have those moments to myself during the writing process that didn't happen on the road because they were so... I was so controlled, so in the zone, so racing. I mean, the last one was just a couple of years ago, the Africa, which was kind of a, looking back, a bit of a training ride for the world. So this was smashing
It's a lot thinner as well, isn't it?
Yes.
That was fun.
Maybe I've got better as a writer. Maybe I can write more concisely. When I first wrote that book, my editor didn't thank me because I handed in 205,000 words.
Whoa. What's that, about 80 or 90,000?
Yeah. Yeah. And the editor said, we don't need to put the readers through the same feat of endurance that you went through. So maybe I've got better at writing concisely. But no, I do enjoy the writing process. I mean, this one, which was a 6,000-mile race down from Cairo to Cape Town, it was a great example. You know, absolutely racing. But equally then coming back, spending far longer writing the book than I was actually out on the road. And just wonder at what, you know, remembering such wonderful moments. Even though I'm racing, I can't write that enthusiastically about cycling. Mm-hmm. This is going to sound very counterintuitive. There's only so much you can write about turning the pedals on a bike. I know people have tried to write a lot about it, but I bore myself writing about that. The reason I ride a bike is because of the places it takes me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a Tour de France rider. I'm an ultra endurance rider because it takes me across incredible countries, continents, landscapes. That's the addictive part for me. So the books are very much about where the bike took me, even though I'm not getting off and having the same sort of cultural experiences that, say, the Al Humphreys of this world was. I've got massive respect for the nomadic travelers. It ain't me. I couldn't do that. And horses for courses,
and
they can
do. And performance is an important element of...
But I also think the intensity... gives a wonderful connection with the world around you. Mm. You know, there's a real purpose to these journeys, which gives you a real appreciation. You end up seeing the world like a slideshow, like a tapestry of cultures and people and places. And you also really need the friendship of strangers because of how you're traveling. You know, you need the food, the water, the safe place to sleep. Mm. You need the world around you. You need to, and that builds sort of wonderful connections, which I often think wouldn't happen if I was just sort of going wherever the wind blew. But they're not really a bike. They're not really books about my gear ratios or my tire pressure. I'm not that sort of bike rider. Bike's just a tool for the trade, which took me on a journey. And so I think people, bike geeks, are quite often disappointed when they meet me to realize that I'm not that passionate about bikes. I'm passionate about where bikes take me.
Did the world, this is an odd question to ask maybe, but did the world feel like a different place from the one that you saw essentially a decade ago to what you saw now? And, you know, we all know, and despite some of our established leaders saying there's no problem in the world whatsoever with global warming, but did you see a difference? Did you, having whizzed around in rapid fire time, what could you kind of describe about the differences in what's happening out there now?
Okay, I'll answer that quickly, but in two parts. In terms of context, if you cycle around the world at the speed of 240 miles a day, if you got around the planet in 80 days, there's days that last forever. There's landscapes that go on forever. And so in that sense, it makes the world seem utterly vast. It gives you a complete appreciation of the scale of the planet. And yet, I got around the entire world in 78 days. And that makes it seem incredibly small and connected. Yeah. The wonderful thing about cycling across the world is, rather than flying, is that you see similarities. You join stuff up rather than differences. Rather than just flying into a place on work or on holiday and then talking about how different it is to home. That's different. This is different. It tastes different. They look different. Well, if you cycle there, you see how things change and you see the similarities. So it gives you a completely different viewpoint on the world because you're joining it up. So that's interesting. A couple of the big documentaries I've made, like Rowing the Arctic, like The Commonwealth Journey, have sadly and in a very forceful way brought me face to face with some of the changes. The journey we did through the High Arctic, which was incredibly difficult in 2011, you could only just get a boat that far north. You could now do every summer holiday in a sailing boat.
Wow.
And some of the filming I did from places like Tuvalu, Kiribati, Nauru in the Pacific, those are islands that are disappearing that I doubt my kids will get to see. So no, I have seen that, but I'm also aware that I'm part of the problem because I travel so much. So hopefully that's not too heavy a place to sort of touch on, but it's a big conversation with myself. How do I share these journeys, continue to do what I'm passionate about whilst minimizing the footprint that I have?
Well, I don't know about you. I could talk to you for a very long time, and I'm conscious actually that you probably would like to ask Mark some questions. So before we do book signing shortly, would anyone like to ask Mark a question and stop me hogging the stage? Just need to speak up a bit louder. It's not...
Hi, Mark. I really enjoyed reading all your books and
thank you.
I've enjoyed following you in Strava around the world, did a day-to-day trip. Can you just say something about the mental strength that's needed to do what you do? Because, you know, I can imagine you can prepare for the physical aspect of it, but the actual mental strength of doing what you've done, getting up every day, you must feel really, you know, hellish, and getting on your bike and cycling. Just how you prepare for that.
Yes, I can try to. It's a hard one to answer, but I never give myself a plan B. I do a lot of risk assessments to figure out what we do if things go wrong, but I think the most important thing when it gets incredibly difficult on an expedition is to have a script to read off. I think what people do on journeys a lot is when the going's good, they make better ground, and then when the going's tough, you know, they feel bad or there's a storm or the terrain's not right, then they just sort of think, right, well, I'll protect myself, I'll do less today, and I'll make up the ground on a better day. And you try and make up the averages like that, mentally and physically, is completely unsustainable. And I don't think anyone is mentally strong enough to sort that average out on the road. I'm always utterly obsessed with my team. Don't meddle with the plan. We are riding 16 hours a day, come rain, shine, hail. So it's not a case of riding 20 hours on a good day and 12 hours on a bad day. If it's storming, if I'm ill, if things are going right, it doesn't matter. We're putting the same time on the bike. I'm not thinking this through on the road. And if I take myself out the equation, I can just, as long as I'm safe to operate the bike, I just need to be on the bike turning the pedals. I think if you are leaving it to your own sort of will and want on the road, nobody has enough moral fiber. If you've given yourself an escape hatch, at some point you'll jump through it. So you cannot have one. Take care of the inputs, the long-term average will take care of itself. And the fear of failure. I had a team, if you include everyone involved in this project, with 40 people who believed in me. I wasn't going to turn around halfway through the project at 3:30 in the morning and say, oh, I'm just going to lie in for another 20 minutes because I can't be bothered getting out of my bed. It wasn't the allure of the light at the end of the tunnel. It wasn't the allure of the 80 days and the big prize. It's the absolutely confounding fear of failure. The expectation on myself, the professional expectation of sponsors, of you guys following me. I'm far more driven by what I'm running away from than what I'm running to. I think when you're sitting there with a blank sheet of paper dreaming of what you want to do, that's when you're inspired by the prize. I'm not particularly inspired by the prize when I'm on the road. I've figured out a plan and I'm absolutely telling myself the consequence of failing and not even giving myself that an option. So I think I just take that equation off the table. I don't know if that helps. There was a question here.
Okay. It's a dodgy microphone, so. Can you, sorry.
Mucked up your whole thing.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel that somebody was going to delay you for so long that you'd lose your time?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, some of the border crossings we went through were quite tricky. One of the guys I employed was specifically to get me through the Russia-Mongolia-China section without any delays. I mean, we got across each of those borders, I think, in record time. But everything was absolutely nailed before we left. You know, we had letters from the highest authorities we could get. Nothing is sure fast, nothing was certain, but we'd taken every precaution we could. And here's another example. From wheels touching down in Perth, Australia, to me riding out the airport was 35 minutes. One of the most useful sponsors we got
was
Menzies Aviation, and I targeted them for a reason because they were ground handlers at every airport. So by the time I was met off the plane in my Lycra, marched through, missed all the queues, got on the bike and went, by the time the rest of my crew came off with all our kit, cleared customs, did all the normal stuff, I was 60, 70 kilometers down the road. So all those marginal gains happened long before the start line. You know, that's why I had a researcher on this project for an entire year whilst I was cycling the length of Africa and doing other stuff before I built the logistics team and everything else. I think it might look like, you know, we just got on our bike and went and figured out. But the stuff that you're concerned about, I had many sleepless nights about. And we tried to choose the route with the least bureaucracy. And we tried to negate as much of those delays as possible. But you're right. If we'd lost half a day anywhere, pretty hard to make back.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. So,
hi, Mark. Having cycled around the world 3 times, is there anywhere that you haven't been that you would like to go to? And when can we expect the latest expedition to hit our screens?
Okay. There's tons and tons of places I'd still like to cycle. I'd like to take the middle route through Asia. I've done the southern route, the northern route. This time I'd like to go back through the stands, so Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. It's a bit hillier, though. If I was to go back to one continent of the world and explore more, it would be Africa. I absolutely loved it. I never unpacked my tent in Africa. I never had to ask a second person for a place to stay. Not sure if that would happen if you were cycling John O'Groats to Land's End. And in terms of the documentary about the 80 days and the book, they should both be out this summer. So, 2018. So if you watch on social media, I'll update plans. I'm furiously scribbling the 80 days at the moment, and the documentary's in the edit. So we're not sure yet, actually, which network it's going to be on. Could well be BBC, but that's been discussed right now.
Cool. One more question.
You rode the Hebridean Way from Battersea to Butterblewis.
Yeah.
I did it last summer, but I took a little bit longer than you did. You did it 180 miles in less than 24 hours, I believe. Yeah. Do you have any reflections on the Hebridean Way?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm a proud Scot, and I've loved exploring and filming some cracking routes over the last couple of years up in Scotland. I mean, the Hebridean Way is right out there on the Atlantic. You get the best of the Scottish weather. My favourite flight in Scotland is leaving from Glasgow, going over the Western Isles, over Skye, and then landing on the beach on Barra. You take off in a city airport and you land on the sand. And from there, I started the cycle up through the 10 islands, across the causeways and the ferries. Could climb through Harris. It's staggering. It's absolutely beautiful. You feel like you're on the edge of the world. And I think I'm definitely going to go back, probably cycle it next with my wife and kids and a bit more time. Quite a lot of the routes I've done in Scotland, I've done really fast as a publicity stunt. You know, like the North Coast 500 from Inverness, 500 miles, I did in 37 hours. I didn't get off the bike. Which kind of takes the fun out of it. I mean, I went from 6 a.m. on the Monday morning to 8 p.m. on the Tuesday evening, just didn't stop. That route should really be done over a week. But I could talk all day about cycling in Scotland.
Cool. Well, I think that's... guys, this is not the end, because Mark will be signing books over there. Basically, if you kind of swivel to your right-ish, you'll see a Stanford signs there, loads and loads of books there. So if you'd like to chat some more with Mark, and even better, buy one of his three books that he's got with him now, then please do. But Mark, thank you for being a superstar, legend, hero to us all. And it's been an absolute honour to chat to you. And thank you to everybody here for listening.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.